I'm Celine McKay, and this is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 34. I have an exciting interview today with a guest I know you will all love to hear from. She is a stylist, photographer, blogger, and advocate for slow living, and her name is Beth Kirby. She's the authoress of Local Milk, a blog so many love and admire, and it's likely you also follow her swoon-worthy Instagram too. I'm very pleased to be able to offer a conversation with the inspiring woman behind it all. I'm going to keep this short so we can jump into the interview. It's a great one. Beth speaks openly about her life's trials and triumphs, how she developed her talent and established her voice, and how she's able to earn a living doing work she truly loves and is passionate about. We talk about travel, photography, life, and love, as well as connecting to your community and supporting local and sustainable makers and goods. There's a lot in this episode. Here's Beth. So, Beth, just as a way of helping us get to know you, I wonder if you could just talk about a few of the defining moments that led you to the life that you lead now.
Oh, man, that's a, a big question. Honestly, I guess the decision to start the blog would be the most defining moment. Okay. And that was sort of this realization that I could just do it. There wasn't anything to wait for, you know, like, oh, I'll do it when X, Y, or Z. So the day I just decided to start it was probably that major turning point. But the point before that was I was kind of a party girl, to put it lightly, probably throughout most of my 20s. So ceasing that lifestyle was the first turning point. The second was about a year later when I decided to start the blog. And then the third, I would say, would be this February when I met my now husband. And now it's, like, complete.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm definitely going to ask you about that last bit later. But what was the process like of quitting that party life? Was there you were just tired of it, or the main reason for wanting to quit that?
Yeah, you know, I was tired of it. It was tired of me. I mean, to call it a party life at that point, I was 28, would be a misnomer. There wasn't any partying to it. It was a lot of sitting at home and drinking cheap vodka and not really doing anything with my life, which is what I think, you know, the party life can turn into unchecked. You know, when you're 21, everything's fun. By the time you're 28, you haven't stopped. Everyone else has moved on. And all of a sudden, the party part has been removed, but all of those behaviors are still there. So for me, I mean, was I tired of it? I had no intention of quitting. To be honest, I got pretty much railroaded into rehab when I was 28 by my family. They were like, you know, we don't want to do this, but we can't have anything to do with you unless you clean up. And I was like, well, I don't want my family to go away, so I guess I'll do this because I don't have a choice. And really, it was kind of a strange miracle. Something just clicked. In that time that I was sort of in treatment, and it actually took, because it doesn't always take. Like, a lot of people get forced into rehab and they don't actually change. They just go back out. I know, it was actually my second time in rehab. The first time didn't work. So it was really just a crazy mix of timing and luck and my family, and something just clicked and changed, and I never really looked back after that. Yeah, it's intense. People are like, really? I'm like, yeah. I was a really different person.
Yeah, and I mean, that transformation is a little, I mean, it's surprising and it's major.
Yeah.
So how far after that did you start the blog?
It was about a year later. So I would say, you know, when you've kind of really descended into drugs and alcohol, it takes about a year to learn how to be a human again. I mean, just all the normal functioning things that everyone else takes for granted. You're like, oh, you like sleep at night and get up in the morning, as opposed to vice versa. And you take showers, and, you know, you have to figure out ways to fill your day. You know, I remember I started doing yoga pretty much religiously, especially there in the beginning, just to give myself something to do, because I didn't actually know what people did anymore. It's like 10 years of that lifestyle, and you kind of forget. Now I can't imagine, like, how did I have all that time? Like, what was I doing? Now I can't imagine having all that free time, but then I just didn't know what to do at all. So I had to relearn how to live in a really basic sense for that first year.
Yeah, wow, that's big. So then you probably didn't just jump right into the life that you're living now. The progression, like you said, like it was slow and mm-hmm. you have to relearn it. But in terms of starting up Local Milk, what was it about in the beginning then? Like, did you always want to take it in this culinary sort of aesthetic lifestyle direction? Or what was the spark that inspired you to start it in the first place?
Short answer, yes. I did always want to take it in this direction. But really the big spark was food, was cooking. I was a cook long before I was a photographer. And I quickly realized no one cares about my recipes on the internet if there's not a nice photograph. So really I started photography in service of cooking because I wanted people to make the recipes. I wanted them to be seen and enjoyed. So I realized, you know, I don't get to skip this step. I have to learn photography. And then I quickly realized, oh, wow, I really like photography and found I had an aptitude for it. So it kind of became its own thing, not just in service of cooking. But it started out as a way to share recipes.
Yeah, okay. And how long ago was that? I'm sorry.
No, it's like not that long ago. I want to say 3.5 years. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Gosh, a lot has changed.
Yeah, it has.
So I a lot of readers had questions about photography, and I'm going to ask you those later. But for now, I wanted to ask you about cooking. Where did your love of it and passion and knowledge of it come from?
I guess I would say it's pretty much inborn. No one in my family cooks, and my immediate family, I should say. My mother does not cook. My father does not cook. I grew up on Wendy's and Applebee's and all of that sort of fast food. But my grandmother cooked, but she died when I was 14, so it's not like I ever really learned from her because I was a kid and then I was a stupid teenager and she was gone unexpectedly. So the seed was planted with her. And I also had an aunt that was a great cook, my mother's sister. She lived in Alaska most of my life. So she wasn't really around either, but I do remember times in her kitchen when we would visit were a big influence on me. I was like, ooh, freshly grated nutmeg. You know, it was this novel concept I discovered in her kitchen as a kid, little things like that. But for me, I'm completely self-taught, 100%, and just always kind of had an affinity for it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. Do you have like a favorite cookbook that sort of... Did you just literally just dive in and try?
I'm not really a cookbook user. I'm a cookbook reader and a cookbook collector. But my cooking style is not to pick out a recipe, then go and acquire the ingredients for that recipe and then make said recipe. I am usually just at the market and looking at what's fresh and what's available. And then I'm looking at whatever cool ingredients are inspiring me. You know, spices or produce or whatever. And so usually what I cook on a daily basis evolves out of that, not from a cookbook. But cookbooks serve to inspire a lot of it. But right now, Heidi Swanson has a cookbook out called Near and Far, and it's like literally right by my computer right now. I really like her work, and that's one that I actually have cooked out of and have really enjoyed.
Yeah, oh, great. So then... you mentioned about the ingredients, and I mean, my husband's a cook too, and that's where his inspiration comes from. And I think that's the truest form of inspiration when it comes to cooking, actually. So you live in Chattanooga,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of place is that? Like in terms of fresh local ingredients, do you have an abundance of it year round? Do you have to travel to get it?
We are blessed with really great farmers markets here in Chattanooga. Specifically on Wednesday, we have a market on Main Street, which is a lot of the sustainable farms in town, the smaller farms. And we also have a really big market on Sunday, which is nice, but I prefer the smaller Wednesday one. So we have really good produce, and we do have it year-round. The hours are just a little shorter in the winter. I think that our farmers markets are even better than Nashville, which we're really lucky being a smaller town.
Yeah, absolutely. How big is Chattanooga?
I have no idea. That's numbers, 100,000, 500,000. I don't know. It's small. It feels tiny.
And it's close to Nashville, though?
Yeah, it's most of my friends that I work with and hang out with actually live in Nashville, but my family is here in Chattanooga. I don't know how it ended up that way. It just did. So I'm a two-hour drive south of Nashville.
Right. Well, it's kind of like me. I'm 2 hours north of Toronto. Mm-hmm. So I live in a super tiny town, much smaller than Chattanooga, I imagine.
Yeah. Chattanooga, you know, it's got some stuff going on. I'm just really, I mean, I don't want to use the word reclusive because that sounds kind of troll-like. You know, I'm social. I get out. Not in Chattanooga, really, though, mostly in Nashville. I'm really focused on my home and my work and my family. So if I do have free time, I'm probably going to, like, see my baby niece and not, like, go out on the town with young people. I don't know, whatever people do, socialize. You can tell how odd. It's so funny because I was so social back when I was a little crazier, and now I'm the opposite. I'm very introverted, and I stay at home a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think also that comes a little bit from sharing so much of your life and yourself online, too.
It very much comes from that. It makes me almost hesitant, I think, to be public.
Well, yeah, and especially as your platforms grow. You have quite a wide reach now, so it's almost intensifies that desire to sort of pull back.
Yeah, I think I don't have a hard time being open on the internet, you know, as open as I see fit anyways. But when it comes to sort of being in a small town and going out, I mean, I will physically start sweating if I'm like, are they looking at me? I don't know. I feel awkward. and especially because you have to remember, I made a lot of those young, crazy mistakes in this small town too. So it's almost like I have these two lives and my whole past is here, but my present is here. And I think it just makes you, because I, you know, I made a choice that made my life a little more public than I really think I ever anticipated it being. I don't think you really see that happening when you start, but it definitely makes me keep to myself a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's also, I'm sure, lots of admiration for being able to pull yourself out of that life.
I think so. My intent, I guess, in sharing it as opposed to just keeping it like completely secret and be like, that's none of your business, internet. Because I think that that's a really valid point of view too. It's nobody's business, but I feel like if it had been me and I was still in it and I read blogs back then, I don't know. I feel like I would have taken solace in someone like me, making it out and doing something, you know, something at all, big or small. It's just, if it can help anyone, then I'm okay to be open about it, but it definitely, puts you out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's actually really admirable, and I agree, because from the outside looking in, you know, through Instagram or whichever, your life has this allure of perceived perfection.
Funny.
I'm sure it's like you, but just, you know, it does look that way sometimes. And so even if readers aren't fighting something major, mm-hmm. like you, just fighting little things.
Yeah, because I still fight those little things. And I think that I am very into perfection in photography. It's my art. It's my craft. I want to do it to the best of my ability. But the danger in that is that's what people are seeing, and they can misinterpret those, you know, really controlled photographs as, perfect life. And A, to let them know, not only was my life not perfect for a decade, it was, I mean, a real train wreck. But even now I have all the same, you know, struggles and overwhelm and messes. And it's funny because I was reading some of the questions. People are like, oh, ask her, like, what does a normal day look like? Or little rituals. I'm like, oh, I don't know. There is no normal day. it's, you know, I kind of get by just like everybody else, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every day's different.
Yep.
That's the thing. And sure. I think if every day is not different, then you're not truly living.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you mentioned that super briefly, but, you know, just about that curation and the perfection, your images and all that, like, you know, like I said before, especially from your Instagram feed, it's clear that parts of your life truly are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I've heard you say before, that you You said that to create great content, you have to live great content. Mm-hmm. But how specifically do you do that? Like, how do you capture those moments of perfect imperfection, as you put it in your on your website? And, you know, like, for me, a mess is just a mess.
Yeah. for me, too. The perfectly imperfect messes do not occur organically. It's styling. It's part of my job. They are visual stories that I am intentionally creating. And I consider that art. It's a humble art form. We can consider it high art. But to me, they are stories intended to get people inspired to live those moments themselves. So while their moment may not look as pretty, and even my real moment isn't going to look as pretty as my photograph, the end game is that someone would bake. Someone would make tea. Someone would go buy flowers. They'd go to the market. They'd take a trip. They'd make that extra effort to, like, make a pretty corner or take some sort of moment for themselves. So I see them as visual stories designed to inspire actions that improve just a little bit the quality of everyday life.
Right. I mean, I love that. I completely agree. But then, yeah, like, how much of your time is spent creating those moments?
All of it. Yeah. All of it. It's either spent thinking about it, actually doing it, cleaning up after it, editing it, posting it. My life is my work. I mean, pretty much all day, every day is spent in some capacity, be that editing or the boring back end stuff. You know, a lot of it's on a computer screen. Whether it's the writing aspect, the editing, updating a website, I would say that so much of my time is devoted to it, but it's because I knew that I wanted it to be my job and I wanted to make a living doing it in some capacity and always do in some capacity. So that's why.
No, absolutely. I mean, I understand completely. And, you know, I think it's important as well for some to realize that it is curated and it's created, too, because it's sort of a checks and balance kind of thing.
What I like to say is I'm sharing my work, not my life. You know, to me, I look at social media like Pinterest or Instagram or the blog as a place to both share and support creative work. I don't really want to be a voyeur into your personal moments. It's nice when people share bits of themselves, and, you know, I'm very open on it. But ultimately, I am making conscious decisions about what I do and do not share because it's my job, it's my work. And I think it's a beautiful place where creatives can connect with their audience and their colleagues. And I think when you look at it that way, it makes it a little easier to divorce the perfection from the person.
Yeah, that's it. That's a good way of putting it. So then who takes all the photos of you as you're going? Like, you know, when you're on your Instagram feed or whichever, those moments that come up. Well, first of all, I wanted to say as well that I think it's really helped to train us as well to see the beauty in everyday life too. Because you do create those moments, but at the same time, you have to notice those moments.
Yeah.
And I think that that's an important skill because so many of us, you just live life and it's a blur and you just, those beauty, that those little hints and moments of beauty pass you by too. So that's another side effect of what you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's like really important to train your eyes to see, because a lot of them do occur organically. It's like, I am making biscuits. Oh, here's a nice mess, or this is happening. And, you know, it's like maybe moving something an inch or two to get that composition. But, yeah, it's both seeing it and making that active effort to create and make things that you can both enjoy in real life and take photographs of.
And you mentioned as well that this is your work, this is your living. So I wondered if you could actually explain everything that you do in order to earn a living. So is it just blogging, or what is it that your work entails, and how did you sort of find your way in that kind of work?
Well, first of all, I'm still finding my way. I think in this kind of brave new freelance world of blogging, it's constantly changing. Still, the landscape is always changing. And I think that that's one of the most important things to making a living doing what I do, which is lots of things, is to always be looking for how is the landscape changing. Like, if this part of my income goes away tomorrow, what am I going to do to change and make up for it somewhere else? So it's a really patchwork living. I sell photographs naturally as a photographer, and I do editorial photography work and styling for both corporations and for publications. And if it's work that is to pay the bills, that's good client work, it's not necessarily going to make it into my portfolio. But I will take the job. So there are those jobs that sort of pay the bills, mostly creating photography and styling content. And then there's sponsored work, which is essentially advertising. That is an aspect of it. There's advertising, photography, styling, and also I host retreats. So those are another aspect of how I make a living. And it all just sort of comes together. And sometimes one's a really big piece of it, and sometimes it's a small piece. And it's just sort of constantly in flux.
Mm-hmm. So then where are the cues that you look for to sort of see how the landscape is shifting?
I mean, it's something I think about constantly. Mostly you think about potential scenarios. You're like, okay, say Instagram is no longer a viable place to do sponsored content for people. Nobody's paying for it anymore. Nobody wants to. Okay, what would I do then? It's like, well, what do I actually do? I'm a photographer. I'm a stylist. I'm a cook. You can always get work doing that. So there's always the option to go into event styling. There's the option to focus more on editorial and commercial work with photography. And you just sort of know. Basically, what I always tell people to do is look at people who are making money doing what you want to do and see how they're doing it. And there's lots of different ways. People who do photography make their living lots of different ways. And you would just want to know all those different ways you could, and then you would pursue that.
Yeah, it's funny because it's not always apparent.
No, it takes a bit of research, and you know, reaching out and talking to people, making friends in your field helps. It not only helps with getting jobs and making connections, but it just helps with sharing information. And that's the really cool thing about the creative community. It's very open. I think most of us take a rising tides lift all approach. It's not very competitive. The way I see it, if somebody wants me for a job, they'll hire me. If they want you, they'll hire you. Like, it's creative. You know, we're not the same. So I don't feel like we're ever in real competition. Mm-hmm. So people are very open with information. You know, like right now, if you ask me, how do you make money? I'll be like, this is how, X, Y, Z. And that could change tomorrow. But yeah, I'm always looking at different ways the business can evolve. I'm like, okay, I could go into retail. I could have an online store. I could do local events and just style weddings if I wanted to. I don't at all because it's really stressful. No, thank you. But yeah, I mean, you can really pursue all sorts of different avenues with your creative trade. You just have to look where are the opportunities in the market to get paid for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you, Instagram seems like it's a really big part of your... Is it the main platform that you use to grow your audience?
Blog and Instagram, they work pretty synergistically together. And see, it used to be Pinterest, but then Pinterest kind of slows down. And then Instagram picks up. And, you know, they could both go away tomorrow. I hear Snapchat's kind of a thing. I can't be bothered. It really stresses me out. I tried to Snapchat for a while, and I just couldn't get the hang of it. But... yeah, Instagram's a really big part of it right now. But again, to me, that's just one version. You kind of have to look at, it's like, am I doing Instagram for a living, or am I doing photography and styling for a living? And it's kind of a combination. You're being paid both for your photography and your styling, but you're also being paid for your audience and access to that. So, but it's like, if that goes away tomorrow, you can still get paid for those actual like core skills of the ability to cook or take a photograph or style something, and you just have to look for where to go to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I feel as I have so many questions about that, I could ask about it forever. However, I wanted to move on and ask you about love. So it's a big theme in your life right now, and a reader did ask how you met Matthew, but I also wanted to know how it's changed you to find true love, and how would you even define true love as it means to you?
Cool. How would I define it? I wouldn't. I wouldn't define it. is unreal. Yeah, it's really, really hard to put it into words. I can do it much better when I'm writing. It's just sort of this like constant giddy feeling of really liking someone a lot when you've never ever experienced that before. It's just a constant light in my life. Every day is a dream. I mean, it really is. It's like, is this real? Could this possibly be real? It completely colors your entire world. And it's funny because, I mean, I wasn't looking for it. And I wouldn't, I guess I had a type, and he's very different in some ways from my type. And I think those are the ways in which he's perfect for me. Yeah, I don't know. It changed everything. It just changed absolutely everything. I feel much more at peace and more content and safe and mostly just happy. I'm so incredibly happy. I wouldn't have called myself unhappy before, but in contrast to how I feel now, I look back and I'm just like, oh, that was the worst. This is so much better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. So how did you meet?
He picked me up in his coffee shop. Pretty much. We've met a couple of times. I would come in and, you know, grab a cortado to go when I was in town, and we'd spoken a little bit. And one day I was in there and he got my number, I thought for work reasons. But as I have said in other interviews, I quickly found out it was not for work reasons. And I pretty much was in love with him by the end of that day. I was sold completely.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm happy for you.
Yeah, it's amazing.
How long have you guys been dating? And you recently got married, so congratulations.
I did. Thank you. We have known each other since February.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really fast. It was one of those when you know sort of things. Yeah. I like had never, ever, ever experienced in, you know, my 32 now years, I don't know how old I am, anything like it. It was just like, I have to have you. Like, you have to be in my life. If I don't have you, I'm going to die. And I felt like a teenager, and I was just like, this has to happen. And we started dating in March, and then I left the country for 3 months within a week of us starting to date. And then I got back and we were married within about a month of that.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
So it was just really, really intense. And we were both 100% sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it could have been a mistake. That's what I always say. I could have been wrong. I didn't actually know him. I was just in love with him and I lucked out. And he turned out to be an amazing guy. Because I think, you know, I didn't know. I was just like, all those chemicals are going in my head, all that dopamine and oxytocin or whatever. And I was like completely gone in love. And as I've gotten to know him more and more, it's become apparent like what an amazing person he is. But, you know, I don't think that our spider senses are some wonderful, foolproof mechanism for making life decisions. I was just very fortunate in this case.
Right, exactly. You know, one of the questions that I had for you, and I don't know, maybe you see what you think, but when, you know, when you're first dating someone, it is like that, well, in the good times, it's like that, and it's fantastic, and it's just like you're spinning in a dream world almost out of control, and it's wonderful. And then, you know, you start living real life together, mm-hmm. and and the little things creep in, and just, you know, bit by bit, sometimes they take a little tiny bit of that magic away. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how to keep that spark alive.
I do. I think for us, the key has been sort of long suffering for the other one when the other one is down, to not get fearful or take it personally when your partner is struggling with something, even if that something is you, because ultimately it's still them. And like for me, given my past, I mean, I can emotionally go off the deep end over nothing. Fact. I will cry and be really sad. Like, oh my God, what did I do? And I'm like, I fall to just, oh my God. And that, you have to be well suited. He is well suited for my particular crazy, and I am well suited for his particular crazy. And I think that is the key, is having crazies that don't drive the other person crazy. You know, neither of us can ever find our phone or our keys. You know, we have bowls of noodles laying in the floor of the closet, and it's like, what? That's normal. So in our really ADD chaotic ways, we don't bother each other. And, you know, when he has a hard day at work, I'm going to be there and I'm going to be on his side. That's the thing. I'm not going to be like critical, like, why did you do that? And he doesn't do that to me. You know, maybe even when we're not at our best, we're kind of like always in each other's corners. And that makes them the person you want to turn to. You don't ever want to get away from them. So for me, that has been the biggest thing, is that support and patience when I'm insane.
I love that, just being right for your particular brand of crazy.
Yeah, that's what we found. Even our families, that's why we got married so fast. He actually met my family when I was abroad. I think I was in Australia. And he called up my parents and met them without me. And them meeting him, and then I met his family when I couldn't take it. So I came home in the middle of my trip and met his parents. And both sets of parents were just like, whoa, you guys are like the same. But like in this way that would drive other people crazy. And our parents, I feel like our families knew as much as we knew that we needed to get married. And that was another thing that made us not feel like we were making a bad decision, is one, we've both been married before, so we know what a mistake looks like. We're older, and our friends and family were all like 100% behind us.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a big part too.
It is.
Absolutely. And I love as well that you said, you know, to be long-suffering and to be there in it with your partner, because I think so often we worry about the right thing to say to pull you out of it, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
That's not what you need. You just need to wallow and then...
True. It's really true. No trying to save someone, just being in it with them. And making time. I mean, that's been one of the biggest ways my marriage has changed my life, is I'm not the crazy workaholic that I was. And I think it was necessary. You know, I built something in a very short time, and all those hours put in helped. But I actually take weekends now. I didn't pride myself on not taking weekends, but it was just kind of this foreign concept. All my days bled together. It's just you work when you can work, and if something needs to be done, you do it when it needs to be done. There are these days off. And now I'm like, ooh, like taking a weekend off is kind of a cool idea. And I like to just spend time with him. It's just about us and not about work.
Yeah, that's almost been what starting a family has been like for me.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Don't do that.
I am really curious how that will change things.
Yeah, I actually have another question about that.
Okay, cool.
So, you know, you're talking about being a workaholic and about, you know, building something in a short time. And, you know, I wanted to ask you a sort of a funny transition, but about the idea of slow living, because so, you know, like that dissonance right there about being, you know, working so much and then wanting to have this lifestyle. So what is it, for starters,
You know, for me, slow living means something, I think, that maybe something different than it means to a lot of people who hear it. To me, slow living, yes, it involves, you know, sort of these leisurely moments, taking time, like not letting life push you so hard that you don't get to bake, you don't get to have tea, you don't get to pet the cat or read a book. So it really is about pushing back a little bit. It's a lot of it is saying no to other things, so that you can cordon off areas of your life to arrange those flowers, to bake that bread, to make soup from scratch instead of opening a can. Can you do it every day? Maybe, maybe not. That's going to depend upon your circumstances. But it's about pushing back. But also slow living to me isn't this idea that we're living at this languid pace and everything's sort of archaic and we're all Luddites and we churn and grind and do everything you know, some old-fashioned way. To me, slow living is about the core idea that good things take time, and being willing to invest those times, that time, into the work that you want to create, whether that's food or photography or making any sort of object. But just this idea that it's actually a lot of time and effort and energy go into making great things, but to make something great is a slower process. It's just not something that's immediate, convenient, quick, easy. But these are all words. These are the buzzwords, you know, quick, easy, recipe. It's like, you know, sometimes it can't be quick and easy. Sometimes you have to go through these steps to get something truly amazing that's, you know, an experience in and of itself. It's not just a means to an end. So for me, slow living is about that, about investing your time to make things great.
I love that. I think it's so true. And like you said, those buzzwords, you know, like top five things you can do right now.
I'm like, oh, no. But even it goes into like sourcing, like, okay, a pot of grits with water and salt. Matt and I were nerding out over this the other morning because he made these grits. I'm like, this is amazing, but it's just water and grits and salt. And it's because it's even that effort of who made the grits. They were local, you know, organic grits from a small farm, and it wasn't produced on this quick, easy mass scale. So for us, it was pretty quick and easy. We put some water in a pot and it just simmered for an hour and was done. But it still wasn't a quick and easy product because someone on the ingredient end had put that time in to make it great. And I think that's true of a lot of agricultural products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't agree more. And I want to ask you about sort of your approach to local living as well. But just before I do, I sort of wanted to ask you a little bit more about your mindset within your slow living, like you said, because I think a big part of successful slow living is learning how to train your mind to live in the present. Mm-hmm. But that's a tall order for most, including myself. And I mean, I think you would agree with that.
Yeah, totally. For me, living in the present was sort of one of the first tricks I learned before I even got my life together. So I would say in my mid-20s, I started doing yoga. And I would notice when things were really bad or I was really anxious or, you know, just felt like my mind was running away from me, it would be to literally invoke my five senses to draw myself back into that moment. And, you know, I would call it like time traveling, like either I'm in the past or I'm in the future. So I'm either like regretting or worrying. And it's like, how do I like suck myself back into my body? And so I would just try to notice, what do I taste? Like, what does my mouth taste like? What do I smell? What do I see? What do the textures around me feel like? What do I hear? And that's still my number one trick for remaining present, is if I notice myself time traveling, to physically look around me and use those senses to get into the moment.
Mm-hmm. I have the same trick. For me, it's mostly about nature, about the outdoors. Mm-hmm. Notice sunlight filters through the trees, the way that, you know, the lake looks through the trees down the hill, like all those little things. Mm-hmm. That's how I bring myself back. But again, it's a learned thing. So yoga for you is a big part. Like you said, do you still practice yoga, or is that?
Not as much as I did. But I'm sort of trying to get back to it right now. I'm trying to get back into the whole concept of working out. It's sort of that self-care, that can, again, it can get pushed out of the way by all the things that feel more pressing, especially when it comes to my work. I tend to privilege it above self-care. So, you know, if an email needs responding to or photos need to be edited and sent to someone, I'm going to do that and not take the time to go to the gym. But again, my husband has really helped me prioritize myself. So now it's like I try to work out 3 times a week. And then I'm trying to get those like 2 to 3 yogas in there too. So it's like, it's a constant struggle to carve out that time for yourself and to also allow yourself to have the time and not feel like you're being self-indulgent by giving it to yourself. Even when it's something good like working out or yoga, I can still struggle with feeling self-indulgent by taking the time.
Me too. I'm thinking all the things I'm not doing.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is half the time I wouldn't even be getting the things I need to do done, I would just be sitting there thinking about how I needed to do them. So it's like, I'm not actually sacrificing anything by going to that yoga class. And what I've found is when I cordon off more time for self-care, I'm actually more productive in the time that I am working.
I found the same thing. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's like I do crazy things now, like things that would have been unheard of to me. Like I get my nails done. Like mm-hmm. I've never in my life been someone who gets their nails done. But I kind of had this epiphany, like, you know, my hands are in pictures a lot. This looks terrible. And, you know, it's a quiet time to just chill out. So I just decided about once a month, they're not done right now. They look real bad. But just stupid little things, like giving that to myself has been a major triumph because I'm not inclined to give myself things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, me neither. So is that something that you do when life feels a little topsy-turvy, like when stress or being overly busy or worried about, you know, finances or family or different things like that creep in?
Yeah.
That strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's everything. It's going to the gym. It's getting nails did. It's anything that feels to me that somehow in that category of, oh, no, that's for you, that's self-indulgent, everything else has to be checked off before you're allowed to do that. When I sort of set that sort of lie aside and just take the time, whether the list is finished or not, the list seems to finish itself a lot easier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. It's just a lesson to learn, I think.
Yeah, it's hard. It's still hard. I think taking time for yourself is just one of the hardest things to do because I think now more than ever, we can be pulled in a million different directions with email and text messages. It's just easy to feel like your list is never done. So it's easy to always feel like it's self-indulgent.
Yeah, truly. So I'm going to move on a little bit and ask you about, you know, the idea of supporting local. It's something that's come up a lot in our conversation already, and it comes up a lot in your writing. So, you know, I've always admired that you are hyper-tuned to the idea of supporting local and being tapped into the culture around you. So what are your main reasons for doing this?
Well, my interest is threefold, maybe fourfold. Okay. One, supporting the local economy benefits myself, my friends, my family. It's just a really good idea to take those resources that I think we have all been kind of trained to dump into these national corporate entities where none of it sees our own community. So for me, it's about allocating resources to my community. That's one big reason I want to support local. Two is about sustainability. The materials they're using, the methods they're using, be it food or objects to produce them. You know, just because something's local doesn't mean it's sustainable. And if it's local but not sustainable, I'm not particularly interested in it either. So for me, you know, shipping costs, just little things like that. The fact that it hasn't had to travel a long way to get here, especially for food, that's a big one. So local economy, quality, and also for me, there's this sort of unique fingerprint to each place. And that's true of my hometown. It's also true of a small town in Japan, or if I'm somewhere in Italy, I'm equally interested in what people are making and doing there. It has such a narrative quality to it. It has a better story.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I love that sustainability is a part of your motivation, too.
Yeah, sustainability more than local. And that's the thing. Local to me, again, I want with food, it tends to be more important. But for me, it's like if someone is making some amazing olive oil in Portugal, I have no problem buying that. It's about sustainable practices. Like I eat a lot of local cheese because I'm really excited about, for us, it's Sequatchie Cove Creamery. What they're doing is amazing, but it's actually really good too. Just because something's local, I'm not going to encourage mediocrity in my community. I do want to support great things here and everywhere. So it's not just because it's local. To me, local, sustainable, and high quality are what I'm always looking for. But sustainable and high quality more than anything.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that is, in a nutshell, actually how I define what a sustainable object really is. Because if it's not made with quality, it's not going to last.
Exactly.
It's not sustainable, even if it's recycled or whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I truly love that, and I really agree. So you had said that as well, finding that unique fingerprint of the place that you live in. And I find that we can be a little out of tune, actually, with the richness that our own home cities or town offer. We have this wanderlust sometimes, and the grass is always greener kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we become used to it and thus maybe a little blind to it. So what advice would you give someone on discovering what their true local flavor really is?
I mean, I do think it is almost like a really simple switch you can flip in your head and see your hometown like a tourist would or like a foreigner would. Like, look at it as if you hadn't seen it every day for however many years. Take photographs of it. Explore, you know, things that you haven't, that aren't on your path. You know, we all have these daily paths. And just sort of break outside of that. But also research it. You know, who is making, I don't know, woodworking, ceramics, farmers, textile artists in your area? And see if you like any of it. Again, I feel no obligation just by virtue of it being in my hometown to support it, but often you discover things that haven't been discovered yet. Small makers creating these amazing things, and it's really exciting to incorporate them into your lives and to support what they're doing so that they can sustain themselves, so that those crafts aren't lost. I think that's another big reason to support small is I want those things. I want to be able to have access to those things. And if we're not buying them, supporting them, they'll no longer be able to make them.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I mean, even your clothes, it seems, are often made by independent designers. And I really love that.
Yeah. Actually, she's a local Nashville designer, Elizabeth Suzanne, I would say, is responsible for about 50% of my wardrobe, if not more. But again, it's also a great aesthetic fit. Like, I truly love her work. I told her I didn't know what my personal style was until I met her clothing, you know. So it's nice when it can be like that, when you can truly, truly like what someone's doing. And I find that to be true of both Chattanooga and Nashville. There's a lot of makers in both locations that I'm really interested in. I feel local in both. I don't limit myself to Chattanooga.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. Well, 2 hours, that's pretty
I would say regional at the very least.
Exactly. So do you find that it's more expensive to seek out handmade and local or high quality products?
It depends on how you're approaching your shopping habits. A lot of people will be like, oh my God, you know, that jacket is so expensive. But they will, over the same period of time that I would buy that jacket in, buy enough cheap stuff to add up to the same amount. And they'll be getting, you know, more in their eyes for that. But I disagree. I think less is more, and I'm always looking for quality over quantity. And I don't think we need a lot. And I would much, much rather have very few excellent things than a lot of trash.
Yeah. No, me too. Absolutely.
Less is nice.
Yeah. And it's less stressful. Yeah. It's less cheap. It's less responsibility. It's less decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not at a place in my life where I want to have to make a decision about what to wear in the morning. I kind of like all of my clothes to look the same and all go together. And I just grab something and know I'm going to love it and only have like a small selection of options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really, really good way of doing it. And I hope more people sort of adopt that practice too, because I think, again, that's an important link to the sustainability and reducing the consumer culture we live in.
Mm-hmm. It's like you don't need 3 coats. You just need one. So just pick a really great one, and you don't need to buy a new coat every year. So I think when people understand that, they are less inclined to see that stuff as too expensive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So as part of, you know, talking about affording things, how are you able to travel so much?
Well, most of it is for work. So that would be the number one reason I am able to travel so much is I host creative retreats all over the world. And that is 9 times out of 10 why I'm in a given country. And used to, I wouldn't even tack on a few days to travel because I would be like, I'm here as my job. And if I spend any money, then I'm making less money and defeating the purpose. But now I'm like, maybe I'm defeating the purpose of life if I don't travel for a few days. So I tend to travel either before or after a retreat in any given country.
Mm-hmm. So then what is your top travel advice?
Pack light. That's not very interesting advice. But unfortunately, because I'm traveling for work and my work involves photography and styling, I'm often not traveling light. I've got props and gear and computers and lenses. And it's the worst. I would say the freedom to just have like one bag that you don't have to check and just sort of like float would be an ideal travel scenario.
Yeah, no, that's,
But I would say, yeah, that's definitely my number one travel advice is don't bring a bunch of stuff.
No, it's literally just baggage.
Yeah, it really is. It's more tiresome than you think, and especially when you're on the road a long time. There are laundry facilities almost everywhere, and sinks will suffice in a pinch. But no, that and, you know, to sort of not be scared to travel alone or to go unfamiliar places. That for me, I've always really enjoyed traveling alone. That this was the first time I didn't enjoy it because I left Matt behind. But you do discover people and places that you wouldn't, you know, if you were in the safety of traveling with a companion.
Yeah, no, it's true because you're a little... Well, you're out of your comfort zone, but also you're sort of more open to this, finding those connections, maybe.
Yeah, you're not as self-contained. I think when you have a companion or companions, you become this sort of self-contained little travel group. And when you're on your own, eventually you're going to get so starved for human interaction, even in an introvert like me, Will, that you will talk to a stranger, and that will be really cool.
Yeah,
hope.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
So let's talk about photography for a little bit. That was the top question that listeners had for you. So take us behind the scenes a little bit. How do you build an image?
How do I build an image? Oh, I decide something I want to photograph or I see something I want to photograph. You know, one, I can either say I'm going to photograph this today and make it and set it up, or I can notice something and decide to photograph something that already exists. When you say set up, do you mean style or?
Yeah, like since a lot of your work involves creating an image, then sort of how do you go about doing that if you start with a blank canvas?
I think about a couple of different things when I'm styling. I think about mood. I think about color and texture. I think about narrative. I think about, like, logically what might be in the scene, but also you might see something that's not quite logical, but it's because it sets a mood. So that's where you get your kind of non sequitur objects. You're like, why is there an antler with this cake? Well, it's in an antler kind of mood, that's why. I consider all of those things, and, you know, over the years I've amassed props and kitchenware that I really like. And I just pull whatever I'm feeling that day and start layering it in a way that for me is pretty intuitive. But I'm just always thinking about composition, balance, texture, color, shape, lines as they move through the frame. And all of those sort of things are just running through my head while I'm doing it. And also just sort of that internal, does this look right? What's bothering me about this? And I just sort of go through that process till I have an image I like.
Mm-hmm. Does it take you, is it really fast? It probably depends on the day.
It does. Some days, I would say styling and writing are similar in that I need to feel a little bit inspired to do either of those. Photography and cooking, I feel like I could do any old day. Like I just am always in the mood. It just is less stressful to me for some reason. But with styling, you know, I would say at this point I've been doing it so long, it's pretty fast. It's like if I look at my avocado soup post that I did recently, I mean, the styling is nothing special or fancy, and it probably took 10 minutes, you know, max. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it takes me forever, and even then I have to scrap it, so who knows?
But, I mean, it's about practice, too.
Yeah, practice is huge. I mean, if you look at my early work, it's laughable. I had no idea what I was doing. But the idea is anyone can study images that speak to them and analyze them and find a way to translate that into their own voice. It's about making the effort to really understand what is going on in this image. How did this image come to be? And just analyzing it.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that your aesthetic evolved naturally over time, or did you know what you were going for right from the get-go?
It definitely evolved naturally over time. I had no idea what I was going for from the get-go. I didn't even know what I liked. I thought I liked things that I hate now. I was like, you know, I was completely like a baby. I was totally new. I didn't know anything, which is a really nice place to start because you have no preconceived notions. And you just sort of follow your eyes over time. And I think, you know, I quickly realized I was drawn to darker images, but I also like a really nice blend of modern and rustic in the prop styling. I would say I don't want it to look like a Cracker Barrel. I don't know if everyone has Cracker Barrel, but like a kitschy Southern restaurant with a bunch of antique stuff hanging on the walls. And so, you know, I always like to, that balance comes with mood as well. So if I have something super feminine in a photo, I'm going to want to balance that with something more minimalist. Or if I have something super rustic, I might want to balance it with something more modern and vice versa. Is, you know, not having one sort of thing overpower the frame where it's like a feminine napkin and a plate and then a frilly cake and some flowers and it's kind of like, whoa. Is letting those elements sort of stand alone and speak for themselves and not overpower each other.
Mm-hmm. It's a fine, tricky balance.
It is. And I think you definitely learn over time, but I think what you learn is a little goes a long way, no matter what you're talking about. Whether it's a little bit of linen peeking in or a little bit of floral or a little bit of color, that's going to read as enough. We don't have to overdo it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's hard. It's, well, I think we have a tendency to want, because you're searching for that perfection, maybe.
Yeah, and I always tell people, if you're just starting out with prop styling, like, less is more. Like, don't, just shoot the food. Focus on, especially if you're doing food, you know, style the food before you worry about props in the scene and all of that. Because a great surface with a great plate and a great dish and a fork is, you know, a great photograph. There's really no need to take it any further unless that's just what you want to do.
Yeah, no, for sure. So you talk a lot about moods, and a lot of the mood comes from the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach that?
I wait for it. And also, you know, my house is my studio, so I know the light in my house and what it's going to do at any given time during the day and depending on what weather. So I kind of know when I'm going to want to shoot. I look at weather forecasts. I do prefer overcast days, which I think is pretty obvious. I think a lot of photographers do because it's like a built-in softbox.
It's a flat light.
Yeah, it's just nice, and it's cooler. It tends to be cooler. So it's a cooler, flatter light. But, no, I'm just always keeping an eye out for beautiful light because I only shoot natural. And I don't really control it in any way. You know, early on I was using diffusers and scrims and bounce boards more, but now I just kind of like it to be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way that limits me too, because I think in this day and age, and especially given my career, the compulsion to photograph absolutely everything can be so strong that shitty light is a really great excuse to be like, eh. Like, I don't have to do it. So it's sort of makes you step back a little bit when you just rely on the light to be what you want.
Yeah, that's very true. And it seems like your house is maybe a little dark.
It is. It is dark. There's only one window in the kitchen, which prominently features in a lot of my photographs. And same with the dining room. There's just one window. So I can create that chiaroscuro effect really easily because of the lighting in my house. But also, if I was in a situation outside of that, you learn how to recreate light because you see what the walls are doing, what's bouncing it where. And you realize that light is just particles flowing through space like sand, and that you can just move them and block them and bounce them to create, like, to replicate any sort of lighting situation.
Yeah, no, I love that analogy. So your props then, how do you source your props?
Everywhere.
So you're always on the lookout.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a bit addicted to the props. They drive me crazy. I have too much junk, but I'm always like, but it makes the work. It's a very symbiotic relationship, I think, a food / prop stylist and the people who make the props. my work is highly contingent upon their work. So really the prop styling in a way is just curating and composing. You're not actually making any of the objects. So I'm always relying on the work of other artists to sort of define a big aspect of my work, which is the props. But yeah, I'm always on the lookout. Obviously, Pinterest is a good source for me. Instagram is. I will follow if I kind of see a maker come up. I'll follow them just so I can remember that they exist and hopefully collect one of their pieces. Travel is a big one. Always looking for stuff when I travel. Just always collecting, but also always getting rid of. I think that that's important so you don't drive yourself crazy.
Right, yeah, editing.
Yeah, you got to edit your actual real life.
Yeah. So my last question in this regard is what is the secret to a good background?
I would say movement and texture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I would say backgrounds generally would do well to be neutral, especially if you're shooting food or flowers or anything natural, because a lot of color is going to be occurring there. I think there are some really cool exceptions. Like, I've been dying to shoot on, like, patterned fabric or wallpaper even. I don't know why. It's been one of those things in the back of my head, like, oh, I really want to do this. Yeah. But that would take, you know, you'd have to choose the dish or subject that you want to shoot on that really carefully. But movement, I think that's why things like marble, linen, plaster, concrete do well, is they're solid, monochromatic surfaces, but they have texture and movement built into them. And same with wood as well.
Right. And also all those things absorb light instead of bounce it.
Yes, that's a big one. Like the marble, for me, it's very important that it be honed, which is not shiny, because otherwise it's just going to reflect a bunch of light up into my face, and I don't want that.
Yeah. So, like, I think my favorite background that you have is the one that you photographed the avocado soup on. Is that concrete?
That is my garage floor.
Oh, see, that's, I love
yeah.
that.
It's the best. It's, like, this massive surface with, like, such a great source of light. And I just have to sweep all the spiders out of the way and carry my stuff down the stairs. And, yeah, no, I've been meaning to shoot down there forever, but it's, like, I have to go down the basement stairs with all the food and stuff. So unless I have someone assisting that day, it can become very, like, tedious. And you don't want to leave the soup down there because it's the basement. You're like, oh, spiders are going to get in it. So, yeah, that's what that is. And almost everyone has that in their house if they have a garage, too. People don't know what a nice surface they have built in.
Yeah, I love photographing on concrete. I really, but I don't have any, and so I don't have a garage or anything.
There are some things. There's this stuff called Featherlight that you can buy that makes for great concrete surfaces. You can kind of hand apply onto tables or counters or floors. That in my concrete research I came across looked like a good option for a quick concrete fix.
So it's like a texturing?
Yeah, I think it's some, I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I think it's some sort of concrete paste, but you can put it on in a pretty thin layer. So you could, if you had like laminate countertops, you could actually somehow concrete over it. I don't know. I'm not really technical with these things, but I looked into doing my fireplace with it.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And in fact, it reminds me. Do you have plaster in your house? Is a random question.
No, yeah, I do. The kitchen is half Venetian plaster and half regular plaster. The Jersey Ice Cream Company, which is a home design duo named Tara and Percy, they're amazing people. They specialize in Venetian plaster, and I want my whole house to be that if I can ever afford it.
It's beautiful. I have... another part of my work is actually my husband and I, we operate a business that sells sustainable building materials.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, this is really random, but anyway, it's the material is called American clay, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of thing you plaster it up. It's different from Venetian plaster, but similar kind of effect, and I wondered if that's what you had.
No, but I would be interested. Actually, I don't know technically what they use.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And we have a few rooms in our house done, but not the whole thing. Actually, both bathrooms.
Yeah. No, my bedroom is what I call faux plaster, which is, it's actually just like a, whatever, how much a can of Kills primer costs over a wall. It's just primer. People are like, oh, what is that wall? I'm like, that is primer. That is it.
Okay, well, we've been talking for quite a while, and I just want to wrap up with a couple of last couple questions here. So, you know, I waited purposely till the end to ask you this. I don't know why. So, do you have any plans to start a family? And I know that's a personal question. You don't have to answer it directly. But do you think, I guess my question mostly is, do you think it's realistic to live a lifestyle like yours that includes kids? Because I find I struggle with it to find the balance. I'm curious what your perceived and, you know, premature thoughts on that topic would be.
I definitely agree that my thoughts would be premature. The short answer is yes, we absolutely want to. And it would be great if that was sooner rather than later. But the big question is, can we balance our work with that right now? And I think the truth is you just do. It doesn't necessarily look the way you want it to look, but from all the mothers I've talked to, you make room at the very least for what needs to be done. Again, I feel like people see on the blog and through Instagram, you know, we're talking about 3 30-second snippets that maybe took some time to create of the day, but the rest of the day, it's not exactly glamorous anyway. So I don't think children would really detract from the fabric of my daily life very much. I think that it would be a great addition, and I look forward to having my corners knocked off, if that makes any sense, and having my perfectionism most finally defeated by our future children. No, but I also don't see it as slowing me down. I work from home. I have a really, really lovely lady who works with me, and I think that, you know, us as a team with kids, we can handle it. Matt's in and out of the house a lot. I've got a lot of family here. The way I see it, it may change things, but I'm the sort of person that just says, hey, let's incorporate them. They'll just become part of it, just like my kittens have.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, I think the hardest lesson that I learned was just to release all expectation, because it's never what you think it's going to be, and you have to just roll with it.
That is currently the exercise of my life, is letting go of expectation, and I think that that just becomes even more imperative when you have children. But yeah, I hope so soon.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, well, good luck in that. It's quite a journey.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I won't lie. It's absolutely terrifying. I'm 32, and I can't say that I was ever one of those women that was like, I can't wait to have babies. I'm more of like, I cannot wait to have Matthew Ludwikowski's babies. I've never wanted babies prior to him. So it's a kind of a new thing. It's not something I ever really thought about. My work was my baby. But I know that that has to change when you have actual children.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, I think that's also, I was never like that either. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't grow up thinking, I want 4 kids and I'm going to do this and that with them. And it was just, in fact, I wasn't sure I wanted them at all. But I think meeting the right person does awaken that in you. And also it just sort of sparks this desire to be a family,
yeah,
because you can't just even imagine how it's going to change your relationship and your life.
Yeah, it scares me. You read all sorts of scary things online about what it could do to your marriage and your house. And I believe that, you know, all those things are, nothing's ever perfect, but we also have choices. And I think that it'll be important to me that we continue to prioritize our relationship and our marriage as well as our jobs. And just sort of, it's the balancing act. I want to have a child-inclusive life, but not necessarily completely child-centric, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That was actually a big part of my philosophy too. I think that kids thrive when they're part of your life, and they have to be,
mm-hmm.
but it's sometimes to their detriment if it's focused solely on them. I mean, I've read lots of studies that actually talk about that, you know, helicopter parenting, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this book that talks about how the French raise their children versus how we do, and are North Americans, and it's very stark, the difference. But that's sort of the basic principle, is that kids are just wound, like they're just sort of woven into the fabric of everyday life.
Yep.
As opposed to,
that is my hope.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that I've been successful in that mostly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Charlie's with me everywhere, and I don't worry. As long as she's well-fed and well-rested, it's fine.
Yeah, that's the way we see it. Like, we know, like, with travel. I don't want to stop traveling because I have kids, and I don't care if it's one or three. I know that it'll change the travel, but it doesn't have to stop it. You know, we always, from the beginning, we would joke about it. It's like, okay, we're going to have one on a leash and one in a papoose and the other one in a backpack.
Yeah.
Or the stroller or whatever. I don't think the baby in a backpack. Obviously not a mother yet.
No.
There's like baby backpacks, right? That's the thing. And leashes, I think leashes are totally socially acceptable.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And, you know, as an adult, I think the most interesting people I've met are people who traveled as kids,
yeah,
whose parents went out of their way to expose them to things. And in fact, I'm trying to figure out how we can travel for a whole year.
Wow.
With Charlie.
I would be really curious to hear about how that works out if you do.
Well, it's going to take a bit, but
yeah,
it's something I think about daily.
Yeah. No, I always think about, you know, because I do these retreats. I'm out of the country, you know, 5 to 6 times a year. And I'm like, okay, that'll probably have to slow down. But how will I bring them and incorporate them? That's been a big thing on my mind since getting married, is how I'll weave children into that travel schedule and my work life. But also this sort of resolve of I will weave them in, you know, like it doesn't have to be scary or bad or choosing. It's just changing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Beth, in parting, is there anything else that you'd like to add for listeners looking to fine-tune their lives to be more purposeful and beautiful?
Go easy on yourself. I think that that's the most important thing. Go easy on yourself and don't be afraid to say no. When people want your time and you don't feel like you have the time to live slow, say no and say yes to you and don't feel bad. And on days when it's ugly, don't feel bad. I have ugly days all the time, and I just don't post them on the internet because I'm not in the business of doing that. But yeah, and to not ever see the people out there who do what I do, or, you know, people who are photographers or stylists or bloggers, as having lives more particularly perfect or beautiful than your own, because I am one of those people, and I also know lots of those people, and we don't. We just adept at, you know, squeezing in some pretty squares, and it's not really that much different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for squeezing me in to the podcast. I really appreciate your time. It's been really lovely having you on and talking with you.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
So that concludes my talk with Beth. I truly hope you enjoyed it. If you don't already read her blog and follow her on Instagram, trust me, you're missing out. Find links and show notes for the episode over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Beth. And feel free to leave your thoughts and comments over on our Facebook page at facebook.com/puregreenmag. Thank you for listening. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast.